accession number 4410, real number 1.
Sir John Glubb, real 1. When did you first go to the Middle East, Sir John?
In the summer of 1920, I came back from France just after the armistice. Actually, in, I think, January 1919. And I was sent back for what they called a supplementary course because we'd been commissioned in rather a hurry in 1914. And I on the square in Chatham, I didn't enjoy it very much, having been at the war in France for 3.5 years. And so in the summer of 1920, there was a tribal rebellion in Iraq. And the War Office appealed for officers to volunteer to go out there, because at the same time the army was still being demobilized and short service commission officers were all demanding to be released. So I thought this was a useful opportunity to get off the barracks where at Chatham. And I applied to go out to Iraq and was accepted.
Was there any difficulty in getting accepted? Was there a lot of competition to go?
Well, I don't know at all. I just wrote a letter and received a reply that I would be posted.
Not even an interview?
No, nothing at all.
Had you had any contact with the Middle East before you?
No, I had no interest and no contact. It was just a method of release, or rather, we'll say also, perhaps a desire for further adventures as very young.
And did you make any special preparations before you went out?
No, I don't think so. There weren't any special preparations to make. I went out as a soldier. They appealed for, I think, 350 officers. And all 350 were shipped out on a small ship called the Vita, which appeared to be 100 years old. And it had been used for trooping in the war. So the accommodation was entirely in bunks in the hold. And as it was rather hot in August, going down the Red Sea, and the ship was full of rats, it wasn't very enjoyable.
Where did you disembark?
We had to disembark in those days in Bombay. There were no direct services to Basra. And then you got another ship from Bombay up to Basra.
Was that any better than the Vita?
I think it was, yes. It was an ordinary ship plying on that route. It wasn't a trooper with bunks everywhere.
So this was an ordinary liner?
Well, scarcely a liner. They're very small cargo ships. It was a very minor route. It plied backwards and forwards from Bombay to Basra, just up the Persian Gulf.
And so you were still with your companions from the Vita, the same set of officers?
Yes.
Were they all officers, or were there any
all officers? The appeal was only for officers.
What were your impressions when you first disembarked at Basra?
It was extremely hot. That was the first thing that struck me. Just at the end of the summer, it's very hot on the Persian Gulf. For some reason or other, during most of the summer, there's a north wind. But as the autumn approaches, the north wind stops. And then everything's stagnant and terribly hot. We then disembarked in Basra, but you couldn't go up to Baghdad by train because the railway had been cut by tribes. And the only way we could get up to Baghdad was on the Tigris. So we were offloaded onto barges, and the barges were towed by tugs up the River Tigris to Baghdad. They kept sticking on sandbanks all the way. However, eventually we got to Baghdad.
How did you amuse yourselves on the journey? Did you get bored?
Oh, I don't remember particularly. There were lots of people. I don't know what one did, really. Usually I carry a great many books, but I can't really distinctly remember what I was reading.
What were your first impressions of the Arabs in Iraq?
Well, I don't know about first. Of course, I had no contact, really, with them until I got to Baghdad. Then the rebellion was practically, the fighting was over. But columns of troops were travelling around the country, partly to show the flag and to sort everything out, and also collecting fines of rifles which had been imposed on the tribes who had made the disturbances. And I was an engineer officer, but I was posted to an infantry column as a sole engineer officer. There were no engineer troops. And we went up to a place which the British called Table Mountain on the frontier of Persia. The reason was that they were building blockhouses there because the Diyala River comes out of the Persian mountains. And where it emerges onto the plain, there were a whole series of irrigation regulators built, which distributed the water widely into canals over the plains of Iraq. Well, these distributors had been smashed by the insurgents during the disturbances, and so they had to be rebuilt. And a battalion of Indian infantry was sent up to guard the work that was going on rebuilding. Unfortunately, the regulators were on both sides of the Diyala, so we had to rig up a sort of ferry across the Diyala to carry the workmen over every morning to work the jobs on the other side, whereas they all slept in the camp with the infantry at night. And one of my jobs was working this ferry. When I was there, when you say, what my first impression of the Arabs, that's the first time I ever saw any. Well, not saw, literally, but came in contact with any. And I did this partly because, of course, the work was scattered about and there were all Arab villages and people all around. Also, I was rather interested. So I paid a few calls on in the local villages. They were always, as they always were, extremely hospitable, and I couldn't talk or say anything much, but one can make oneself understood after a fashion. And that was the first time I ever contacted any. The workers on the blockhouses and the irrigation works were all Indian coolies imported from India.
Had you done any of this type of work yourself before? Any of this type of work on the ferry before?
Well, no, but at Chatham, you're given a sort of engineering, or we'll say to some extent, quite a detailed engineering course. So rigging up a rope ferry and so on was not terribly scientific from the engineering aspect.
And how many Europeans were in this area near the river?
There were two. Myself, the officer commanding the battalion of Indian infantry, and there was a British quartermaster who was supposed to arrange all the supplies which came up by train from Baghdad.
And did none of the three of you speak Arabic?
No.
And so you haven't relied on interpreters?
I suppose we must have had an interpreter, but I can't remember very clearly now.
When did you start to learn Arabic yourself? Did you start straight away?
Well, not seriously, I think, then, because I still had not contemplated staying there. I was just doing a job with the army. But from there, I was transferred to the Euphrates, which is the other side of Iraq.
After how long?
About 3 months, I think. 3 or 4 months. And on the Euphrates, I was put in charge of an extremely rickety boat bridge, which was the only bridge over the Euphrates for about 400 miles. And this was made up of local boats, which were made of reeds plastered with bitumen and this kind of thing. And there, again, I had one NCO, a British NCO. Otherwise, the two of us were quite alone, and the bridge gang who maintained it were local Arabs. So there I was obliged to start talking, and did so just in the course of the work, you see, saying, "What's that?" or something, and the fellow would say, "That's rope in Arabic," or something, you see. Then we had various vicissitudes. The Euphrates rose in flood and the bridge was all swept away, and we had to collect the different boats from down the river and tow them back and so on. And this was all done with Arab workers. And, of course, they lived in all the local villages, and as Arabs always will, they asked you to come to their village for lunch or dinner, whatever it was. And also, of course, I got quite interested in my gang, and we got very friendly, and they asked me to their homes, and I had to know a bit of Arabic in order to do the job, and so I gradually got drawn into the thing.
Were you surprised at the level of hospitality when you arrived in Iraq, in view of the fact that it's not very common in Britain to invite people so readily to each other's homes?
Well, not only invite, but of course in Arab countries in those days, any passerby who saw any tent or hut walked in, and everybody said, "Oh, welcome, sit down." And you weren't supposed to ask who he was, even. This would be bad manners. You immediately served him with lunch. Possibly he got up and went away without telling you who he was. So, absolutely fantastic to European viewpoints. Anyhow, the next thing that happened is while all this little business of maintaining my bridge was going on, Winston Churchill held a conference in Cairo to decide British policy in the Middle East after the First World War. And one of the decisions taken was that Iraq, which was a very large country with practically no roads and a great many deserts and marshes and rivers and all sorts of things, would be very expensive to maintain with only military forces. And, of course, after a war, everybody wanted to reduce the army and save money. And the reason why we had to do it was that Iraq, before, had been part of the Turkish Empire. The Turks had all gone away, and the country remained with virtually no government, no police, and no army. But a large proportion of the inhabitants consisted of armed tribesmen who were not nationalistic. They hadn't realized that there were Arabs or English or anybody particular. They took a man at his face value. But they didn't want any government at all. And so it was rather difficult to run a government when there were no local forces. And to begin with, it could only be done with British forces. Although, of course, work was immediately put in hand to train an Iraq police force, an Iraqi army, and various other framework of government. So one of the brilliant ideas which Winston Churchill fathered was to maintain law and order in Iraq with aircraft and not ground troops. This sounded marvelous. The theory was that if you got a signal that a certain tribe 500 miles from Baghdad was in revolt, to send a military column there across deserts and rivers and so on might have taken 3 or 4 months and cost millions of pounds. But, of course, with the Air Force, you took off after breakfast, bombed the rebels, and were home again in time for lunch, and the war was over. So it all sounded too marvelous for words. So while I was still on my bridge over the Euphrates, it was decided that the Air Force should take over from the Army. And Air Marshal duly arrived, Air Headquarters was set up, the General Officer Commanding and his staff disappeared. Well, it was only then that the difficulties began to appear, because it's all very well to take off with your aircraft after breakfast and bomb the rebels, but when you get in the air above the rebel country, you can't tell who the rebels are. The whole country was covered with camps or villages or whatever it is. Tribal boundaries are not demarcated on the ground. So the first few efforts, they always bombed the people who were on the side of the government and missed the people who were really rebelling. Well, this threatened to destroy the whole system of air control. So they elaborated a system by which they would have a call, or we'll say a number of officers on the ground who would each be allotted an area where he would live and with which he would become completely familiar. Then, when in any area there were disturbances, this officer was recalled to Baghdad, put into the aircraft, and told to lead the aircraft to the people who were giving the trouble. These were called special service officers. Of course, the RAF didn't have anybody who could speak Arabic. And you really wanted to speak Arabic if you were going to learn all about the country in your area. So, although I was a soldier and would have gone with the army, the RAF nipped in and asked me if I'd like to stay with them because I spoke a few words of Arabic. So, as I liked Iraq and starting to know the people, I said I would.
What time, what date was this? Can you recall?
21. I can't tell you exactly the time of year. It might just have been 22, I'm afraid. I'm not quite sure. Anyhow, I was attached to the RAF and sent to a number of successive areas. Wherever there was threatened a disturbance, one was sent to that area and told as quickly as possible to become familiar with all the tribes, the camps, the villages and everything else, so that if the thing blew up, you would be able to fly the aircraft and hit the correct target. And on this job, I spent several years, all up and down the Euphrates. I started on the southern end of the Euphrates, which is all marsh, date palms and things like that. And then I also moved up to the higher Euphrates, where is the border of Syria. And in each of those areas, all up and down the Euphrates, I had to familiarize myself with every town, road, tribe, and any possible target which it might be necessary to discipline.
Was there any danger for you in this job, in view of the fact that you are acting as a special service officer for these bombing raids?
Well, we had an interesting operation in 1924, when there were a bunch of tribes on the Euphrates, about halfway between Baghdad and Basra, rather nearer to Basra, who would not come into the government or pay taxes. And what was a bit awkward was that this group of tribes were astride the railway, which was really the lifeline of Baghdad and the rest of Iraq. But they got a sort of modus vivendi because the tribes didn't cut the railway. They realized if they cut the railway, there would be trouble. They just refused to come into the government or pay taxes or have anything to do with the government at all, but allowed the trains to pass through. It's an amusing situation because you see the train for 25 miles or more ran across territory which wasn't under government control. But I say the tribesmen abstained from shooting at the trains. They were willing to live and let live as long as they didn't have to pay any taxes. They let the trains pass. Well, as the administration was building up and getting more regular, the government said, well, look here, we can't go on like this. This area must be brought under control. So they talked among themselves in Baghdad with the air officer commanding and so on. And I got a signal. No, I think I was called up to Baghdad and told that there will be operations in this area. You have got to familiarize yourself with the whole area so that you can fly with any air formation and point out all the villages to the pilots. So I went down to Samawa, which was the town in the center of this area. Samawa was, of course, held by the government, but the officials couldn't go out to the tribes, nor would the tribes come into the officials. It was a besieged city, although nobody shot anybody, unless the government went out to the tribes, in which case they shot at them. If the government stayed in town, the tribes didn't interfere. However, from the town, I couldn't see where all the villages were. So I decided to take a ride out. And I took a couple of Arabs, and we got on the horses and rode out into this territory and dismounted at the little village which belonged to one of the chief men. Well, he's rather taken aback. He didn't expect this, because whenever they'd sent police or anyone out, they'd always been shot at. But they didn't realize who we were. We were partly dressed as Arabs and so on, you see. And we got into his village before he knew what it was all about. So then, of course, to Arabs, guests are sacred. And far from objecting, they put up a large lunch and made tea and coffee, and we had a long talk. And there was a good deal to be said for their side, because everything depends on irrigation there, and irrigation can only be distributed by a central authority, which closes your sluice to open the sluice onto my land, and so on. But if there's no government authority, the fellow higher up the canal takes all the water, and the people lower down the canal get no water at all. So this fellow and his tribesmen explained this. They were well down the canals, and they never got any water. And I said, well, why don't you tell the government? And they say, well, if we approach the government, the very first thing they say to us is, your 50,000 rupees overdue in taxation, when can you pay? Well, we haven't got no money because we get no water. So it's a vicious circle, you see. We can't go into the government. But if the government would arrange the irrigation, that would be a different matter. So I thought it's rather a cad going round here eating their lunches and drinking their tea, was I'm really spying in order to be able to bomb them. So it seemed to me the only honourable thing to do was to say, look, I want to explain all this to you. If you don't come into the government, you will be bombed. And I have been sent here to see where you all live in order that I can bring the bombers to attack you. But the government doesn't want to kill you. They want you to come in and talk. So that I will let you know if this is going to happen. All you have to do is, when I let you write to the chiefs to report to the government, you've got to come. If you don't come, then we shall have to bomb you, and I shall be with them. But I'm telling you now what's going to happen.
Were you obeying your instructions by telling them this?
No. On the other hand, you see, I wasn't betraying the government, because these were not enemies whom the government wanted to kill. They just wouldn't play. And all the government wanted was to get the chiefs in and find out what their complaints were, and theoretically, to satisfy them. But they wouldn't come in, and so we couldn't get anywhere. Well, eventually I finished my... I made a very detailed map showing every village, each one numbered. And on the back of the map there was a list of targets with the numbers, and then if you turn the map over, you saw the number he was supposed to be attacking, you see, marked as a village. Oh, then eventually we had to do it in rather a hurry because all the aerodromes are on Earth. And there were no sort of hard runways. And it was due to start raining in November, after which the aircraft couldn't take off. So in the end, they called me up to Baghdad and said, we're going to start on such and such a day. And the ultimatum is now being sent to the chiefs, telling them to report to the government. If they do, it's all off. If they don't, we shall bomb on such and such a day. So I went back and sent messages to all these people and said, this is what I told you about.